Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
Hello from Stephen Crittenden. Welcome to the Religion Report. Over the past year or so, we've been paying close attention as Malaysian society becomes more and more sectarian. Malaysia has always been regarded as a showcase of moderate Islam, but these days the trend is away from pluralism. In a moment, we'll bring you an edited version of Justice Michael Kirby's recent Griffith Lecture, given at Griffith University a couple of weeks ago, about freedom of religion, apostasy, and the Lena Joy case in Malaysia. Meanwhile, in Kuala Lumpur at the weekend, riot police using tear gas and water cannon clashed with 10,000 ethnic Indian protesters. And you may have seen the wonderful colour photograph of the crowd scene in Monday's Sydney Morning Herald, like a painting by Goya. Ethnic Indians make up 7 or 8% of Malaysia's population. They were brought to Malaysia by the British to work on the rubber plantations, but the rubber industry has long since collapsed. In 1957, when Malaysia received its independence, they pushed for the British government to protect their rights as a religious minority, and Malaysia's constitution, when it was drawn up, contained a guarantee of religious freedom. Half a century later, they're complaining that they're second-class citizens facing poverty and religious persecution, as the government, or private development companies working with government permits, demolish one Hindu temple after another. Well, we're joined now by one of the protest organisers, P. Waitamurthy, who was arrested at the weekend and spent 3 days in jail on hunger strike. As we'll hear, he's the author of a petition addressed by the Malaysian Indian community to the Queen of England. Waitamurthy, welcome to the program. I understand you were charged with sedition at the weekend, but those charges have been dropped and you were released from jail on Monday afternoon.
It's not that the charges are dropped, but the judge found that the charges were ill-framed by the Deputy Public Prosecutor. So the judge gave us, me and two of other my other colleagues, a discharge not amounting to acquittal, which means the public prosecutor can come back, re-arrest us, and charge us again with the proper wordings of the charge.
At a later date?
At a later date. It could happen today, tomorrow, anytime. We are expecting that.
Now, how much is this protest an ethnic issue, and how much is it a religious issue?
It is both combined together, I would say. It is the ethnic minority Indians in Malaysia have suffered serious persecution, religious persecution, as well as other persecutions in other areas, meaning educational, socio-economic, and so forth. So the minority Indians and Hindus in Malaysia have suffered under the current government for the last 50 years. They have remained patient. They have remained silent. However, I think now the community is fed up with the system. They know the system has failed them, and since HINDREF came forward to champion the cause, not only on religious issues but also other issues, they are coming in large numbers. Thousands and thousands of them are coming all out to support us in our cause and in our struggle for freedom and justice.
I understand a number of Hindu temples have been demolished over the last year or so, and there are pretty severe restrictions on public celebration of Hindu festivals.
Yeah, when we say a demolition of temples, it is not a few. According to our statistics over the last 15 years, a minimum of 10,000 Hindu temples have been demolished throughout the country by the government, simply because they now claim these temples had existed for over 100 years, 150 years ago, since the British colonial period. And since achieving independence, the government of Malaysia, the majority Muslim government of Malaysia, have failed to identify these temples in their planning schemes and have failed to gazette these temples as temple reserves, and hence now the government is declaring that these temples are sitting on their land and it is illegal, and they come with their bulldozers demolishing temples in thousands.
And have you been able to take a case to the courts?
We do not have the funds to go to court. It is very expensive to go to court and file for an injunction. So therefore, we have no choice. In any event, as a test case, we have filed for an injunction on a 150-year-old shrine and a 150-year-old tree. which is holy to the Hindu community, about 2 years ago, 2.5 years ago, and it is still pending in court. Even till today, we have not been given the injunction preventing the authorities. These temples belong to the poor community, the underclass community of the Hindu society, and they simply don't have the funds to go to court each and every time.
You talk about the underclass communities. I hear there are high levels of social dislocation and unemployment for Malaysian Indians.
That's correct, yes.
You used the word religious persecution before.
Yes. When I say religious persecution, meaning there are cases where one, either if, assuming a couple is a Hindu couple, you know, either one party converts to Muslim, immediately the government declares that the provisions under the federal constitution, i.e., the religion of the child below the age of 18 is determined by the parents. So in this case, the moment either one party converts to the Muslim religion, the federal constitution, which is the highest law in the country, doesn't stand anymore. Now the non-Muslim party has to commit himself to the Sharia court jurisdiction, and the Sharia court will rule that the religion of the child or children has to be Muslim. We know of hundreds of cases where children are unable to register their birth simply because either one party or the great-grandparents of either one party were Muslims at one time. So therefore, they take it that, you know, this child, the grandchild, is also a Muslim. Therefore, they do not register the birth. So we have cases of hundreds of children who are not able to register. So we take it this is religious persecution.
Are these problems that are being faced by the Indian Hindu minority in Malaysia, are these problems something new, something recent, or are they much more long-standing?
It has been long-standing. It was there all the while. Many people know this, but because none of them dared take up the issue all the while, simply because religion is termed very sensitive in Malaysia, they can arrest a person under the draconian ISA, which is the Internal Security Act. The government always uses Internal Security Act to threaten people, to scare people off from raising these issues. So therefore, people do not talk about this openly until recently, when I and my organization, HINDREF, have been openly over the last 2.5 years openly talking about religious persecutions in Malaysia. And we have been protesting openly. We have been sending memorandums to the King, to the Prime Minister openly, and also to the international community.
Well, now, indeed, at the weekend, the protest rally at the weekend was associated with a petition that you wrote to the Queen of England. What does she have to do with the situation?
Because of all the violations that the Hindu and Indian community in Malaysia suffered, we have no choice. Therefore, I had filed a class action against the British government on 30th of August this year, against the British government seeking compensation for the violations that the Indian community in Malaysia suffered for the last 200 years, i.e. 150 years under the British rule in Malaysia and the last 50 years under the majority Muslim government in Malaysia. Now, in order to succeed, to proceed with the case, we need about either we need £1 million to proceed with the case, or we need a volunteer solicitor and barrister in London to proceed with the case. Now, Malaysian Indians, as I said, we are poor. We can't afford the legal costs. So our gathering on Sunday was meant to be a peaceful gathering to submit peacefully to the Queen seeking for legal representation. But the government turned it into a rally. They say they term it as a rally, as a mass demonstration, simply because they want to prevent the formal handing over of the petition to the Queen.
The British Commonwealth has taken tough measures in recent times against Zimbabwe and Pakistan. Should it be paying closer attention to the issue of freedom of religion in Malaysia?
It should be doing that, but unfortunately, I suppose there must be a party who's going to raise it with the Commonwealth countries. You know, 2 years ago, I went to the Commonwealth Secretariat. I presented a paper, a working paper, with all the grouses of the Malaysian minority Hindus to the Commonwealth Secretariat. Nothing was done. I suppose they would prefer if another member country initiate the action at the Commonwealth level. You know, we are unable to do that, though we have attempted about 2 years ago.
Now, a final question. These protests are all taking place in the context of a looming election in Malaysia. What stand is your main Indian political party, the Malaysia Indian Congress, taking?
They belong to the ruling coalition of Malaysian government. So, of course, they are not happy with this gathering on Sunday, because even they have not seen a mass population of the Indian minority coming out in open to directly show their support to a non-governmental organization, to an organization which has openly voiced concern against the government's policies.
Thank you very much for being on the program. We appreciate your time.
Thank you very much, sir.
P. Waitamurti speaking on the phone from Kuala Lumpur. On ABC Radio National, Radio Australia, online and on your pod, this is the Religion Report. Well, earlier this year we reported on the Lina Joy case in Malaysia's highest court, the Federal Court of Malaysia, which refused Lina Joy's application to register the fact that she'd converted to Christianity. This year's annual Griffith Lecture at Griffith University was given by Australian High Court Judge Michael Kirby on Friday the 16th of November, and Justice Kirby spoke about freedom of religion, apostasy, which is the right to leave one's religion or change one's religion, a difficult problem in most Islamic countries, and he focused on the case of this ethnic Malay woman, Lina Joy, previously featured on our program.
Freedom of religion and conscience is possibly the oldest of the internationally recognised human rights. Protection to it was granted as early as the Peace of Westphalia, signed in 1648 to end the 30-year war in Europe. It's now enshrined in a number of international instruments, including the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, Article 18, and the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, also Article 18. The right to freedom of religion necessarily includes the entitlement to change one's religion, or, as Lionel Murphy often reminded me, the right to throw off religion altogether. Freedom from religion. Whilst the right to freedom of religion is recognised by states, the universal concept of freedom of religion and associated freedom of thought and conscience don't enjoy an easy relationship with revealed religions. Of its very nature, if a religion is accepted as disclosing an almighty God, deserving of wholehearted and unquestioning faith and obedience, it's difficult for many believers to tolerate the postulate of error, the possibility of another god or earthly messenger different from one's own, or to accept that there may be no god. Upon such central or core ideas, people tend to feel very deeply, sincerely, and passionately. In the Abrahamic religions, so it was with the Jews, who rejected the polytheism of their more powerful neighbours. So it also was with Christianity, which for centuries killed and oppressed millions who'd embraced other faiths or even different variants of the Christian belief. Much attention has been given in recent years to the special challenge said to be presented by the resurgence of Islam as a major global religion, and the apparent difficulty of reconciling the universal right to freedom of religion with a supposed tenet of Islamic faith that forbids apostasy, that is, the renunciation or abandonment of a religion into which one was born or later came to profess. In some Islamic countries, apostasy is a punishable offence. A recent decision of the highest appellate court of Malaysia in the Lina Joy case, which is the focus of this lecture, draws attention to the apparent difficulty of reconciling these two concepts.
Justice Michael Kirby. Although Malaysia isn't a signatory to the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, the Federal Constitution of Malaysia guarantees freedom of religion. We don't have time here to go into the details of Lina Joy's case. You can read Michael Kirby's entire lecture online. Suffice to say that she converted to Christianity some years ago and wants her identity papers changed in order to marry. Malaysia's highest court found against her in a split 2-1 decision, with two Muslim judges in the majority and one non-Muslim judge dissenting, ruling that the decision about whether Lina Joy was a Muslim or not belonged exclusively to the jurisdiction of the Islamic Sharia courts. Justice Michael Kirby.
In order to appreciate fully the serious impact on religious freedom in Malaysia occasioned by decisions in cases such as Lina Joy, it's important to notice also two significant, very practical considerations that the case bears. First, apostates in Malaysia are subject to a range of penalties under state legislation. In some states, apostasy is a criminal offence, In the state of Pahang, Section 8185 of the Administration of the Religion of Islam and Malay Custom Act of 1982 provides, quote, any Muslim who states that he ceased to be a Muslim, whether orally, in writing, or in any other manner whatsoever, with any intent whatsoever, commits an offence and on conviction shall be liable to a fine not exceeding 5,000 ringgit, or to imprisonment for a term not exceeding 3 years, or to both, and to whipping of not more than 6 strokes. In other states of Malaysia, apostasy is punishable by mandatory detention at a rehabilitation centre for periods of up to 3 years. During such periods, apostates undergo a course of education, and presumably under the force of this persuasion, they are asked to repent. One of the Islamic parties that has sprung up in Malaysia in recent years has called for the introduction of the death penalty in cases of apostasy, but so far that is not a punishment provided in this respect in Malaysia. Secondly, if Lina Joy were now to apply to a Sharia court for a declaration of apostasy, she would certainly face a number of impediments. Islamic principles discourage Muslims supporting or facilitating renunciation of the Islamic faith by other Muslims. Thus, it would be difficult for Lina Joy to find a lawyer specialising in the Sharia law who would be willing to represent her in such a case. She might therefore have to represent herself. Moreover, Sharia judges might find themselves breaching Islamic law if they granted declarations permitting Muslims to leave the religion. The legal representatives of Lina Joy have stated, quote, in reality, the prospects of obtaining an apostatization order is illusory, given the general belief that apostatization is a sin. The only way that Lina Joy could realistically exercise her right to freedom of religion would now seem to be for her to leave Malaysia, a sad conclusion, or abandon her struggle. In an interview with the ABC's Religion Report, prior to the commencement of the federal court hearing, the chairman of the Christian Federation of Malaysia, Bishop Paul Tan Chi Ing, indicated that the usual advice that he offered to non-Muslims who wanted to marry a Muslim was, quote, if you really want to marry the man or woman, and you don't want to be discriminated, pressured, and sometimes persecuted, then you migrate.
Justice Michael Kirby giving this year's annual Griffith Lecture at Griffith University and on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia Online and on your pod, this is the Religion Report.
Now, in order to understand why apostasy is forbidden in Islam and why freedom of religion is interpreted so restrictively, it's important for non-Islamic people to appreciate the emphasis that's placed in the Islamic tradition on the welfare of the ummah, or community, for which apostasy is treated as relevant. In contrast to the generally individualistic traditions of Western liberal social theory, Islamic tradition presents a communitarian view. It's not unique in this respect. The Confucian view of society likewise lays emphasis on the community prevailing over the individual. According to such concepts, the self is realized collectively. It's defined through traditions and concepts of honor. In Islam, individualism must be realized within the ummah, or community, which is of paramount importance. Accordingly, from a Muslim perspective, the renunciation of the Islamic faith does not simply affect the particular individual concerned, it's a harm to the whole community as well. In earlier times, Christianity was very similar in its approach to apostasy. This was most evident during the bloody wars and forced conversions and burnings of heretics that accompanied the European empires or the Christian Reformation and Counter-Reformation. Because of my family's origins in Northern Ireland, I was raised in the heroic tales of Archbishop Cranmer, who was burnt at the stake, and the Protestant martyrs who resisted Queen Mary. The Roman Catholic Church of my youth in Australia did not encourage Protestants to be married in their churches. It required, in effect, that they should convert or be married behind the altar or make certain promises concerning the children. This was Australia only 50 years ago. Partly from exhaustion, partly from practicality, partly from the advance of rational mutual respect, Christians in Australia and most other lands have generally, although not wholly, emerged from such sectarian attitudes. They've generally embraced an acceptance of the tolerance that lies at the heart of the universal right to freedom of religion and the right to change or renounce earlier beliefs. Looking at the issue of apostasy historically, therefore, Islam, so far, is at an earlier stage in the same journey. In June 2007, Justice David Hodgson, a judge of appeal of the Supreme Court of New South Wales, provided one suggestion as how we should encourage legislatures and courts in Islamic countries to alter their views on apostasy. In an article published soon after the decision of the Federal Court of Malaysia in the Lena Joy case, he noted the doubts raised by the case as to whether Islam was truly compatible with real freedom of religion, and he suggested that one possible means of expelling uncertainties on this score would be for Muslim leaders in Australia and other countries where their adherents enjoy a high measure of religious freedom to speak out firmly and clearly, as he put it, against the denial of religious freedom in countries such as Malaysia. He concluded by stating, if they cannot and don't do this, a doubt must remain.
Justice Michael Kirby, who says that Malaysia's civil courts ought to have upheld the supremacy of the constitutional right to religious freedom, but they failed to do so. If this was a harsh, backward, theocratic regime making such a decision, we wouldn't be surprised. But this is our close neighbour Malaysia, with whom we share historical links and a legal tradition.
The case of Lena Joy has therefore come to us in Australia as a surprise, and we're entitled to express our concern about it. In today's world, no land is an island entire unto itself. We have our faults, and Malaysia should, and sometime does, point them out to us. We can all learn from each other. We also know that the one universal principle that is shared by all of the world's great religions is the golden rule, to do unto others as you would wish them to do unto you. Dr. Teo Li An, an associate professor in the National University of Singapore, became one of the most prominent critics of the Lena Joy case. Amongst her telling criticisms of the earlier decisions, she pointed out from Singapore, quote, "There is a certain agony about this case, which at its heart concerns a woman who wishes to make a change in religious profession and to marry and have a family. Lena Joy is not a religious provocateur out to defame or denigrate a religion which is constitutionally recognised. She's simply a person who wishes to marry and lead a quiet life, which the current legal regime poses obstacles to." End of quote. When I read this critique, I applauded the wise words in which Dr. Teo expressed her views. You can therefore imagine my disappointment soon afterwards to read the Hansard record of the same Dr. Teo's remarks, not a year subsequently, as a nominated member of the Parliament of Singapore a few weeks ago, when the criminal laws of Singapore against homosexual men inherited from Britain were before that Parliament with a bill to repeal them. Making her contributions on penal reforms for homosexuals from an avowed standpoint as a Christian believer, Dr. Teo rallied the opposition to this enlightened and long overdue reform proposal. Her speech on the topic was full of partisan rhetoric. She denounced what she described in the bill as, quote, "the sexual libertine ethos of the wild, wild west." She protested that religious views are part of our common morality, and you cannot, she said, make a human wrong a human right. She said, there are no ex-blacks, but there are ex-gays. Well, amongst the millions of homosexuals, there aren't many of them, and those that exist are mostly in denial to please people like Dr. Teo. She threw in the usual confusion of homosexuality, which the list that she described as bestiality, incest, and pedophilia. She denounced gays, declaring that whilst we cherish racial and religious diversity, sexual diversity is a different kettle of fish. She declared diversity is, quote, not a license for perversity. She asserted that hedonism breeds narcissism and that some desires are undesirable, harming self and society. She defended the present law of Singapore, criminalising homosexual men because the Bible and the Quran declared homosexuality to be morally deviant. She warned in borrowed words against slouching back to Sodom, and she denounced making a mockery of what she called strong family values. Now, we've heard all this type of language from religious zealots in Australia. Fortunately, recent evidence suggests that we're growing up. We're throwing off these infantile, ignorant, and unkind notions that seem so alien to the essence of any true and loving religion. My point is that it's not enough for Christians or people of the Christian tradition to be selective about tolerance and acceptance. We cannot selectively denounce Islam for its views on apostasy, but then do equally nasty and cruel or indifferent things to people at home or elsewhere by invoking imperfect understandings of our own religious tradition and texts. In South Africa, we should never forget that it was scripture that was invoked to justify the former apartheid regime. In Australia, America, and elsewhere, fundamentalists invoke scripture to criminalise homosexuality and to make homosexuals second-class citizens. So in Australia, at least, we must be truly committed to the principle of mutual respect and acceptance that lies at the heart of the worldwide movement for the protection of fundamental human rights, not just for the majority whom we regard as similar to ourselves, for all. So Lina Joy should have our support. She should have it not because she's a Christian, nor because she's seen by some as a person striving to enjoy conventional family values. She should have our support because she's a human being standing up for the integrity of her basic human rights. Those rights are not, as the majority judges in Malaysia said of her case, her whims and fancies. They are the precious manifestation of deep-seated feelings that express part of the very essence of what it is to be a human being. As such, people everywhere should support her. Universal human rights, you see, are awkward and always challenging. They exist in people who are not exactly like ourselves, in minorities that we do not quite understand or even do not know. All human beings, just because they are human. Australians and Malaysians, Christians and Muslims, people of other faith and people of no faith, fair and dark, rich and poor, old and young, straight and gay.
Justice Michael Kirby of the High Court of Australia, and an edited version of his Griffith Lecture given at Griffith University earlier this month. And you can read the lecture or hear it in its entirety on our website at abc.net.au/religion. Well, that's all this week. Thanks to our producers, John Diamond and Hagar Cohen. I'm Stephen Crittenden. See you next week.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. all the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.